ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
You know when a politician says they're leaving the job to spend more time with their family, it often seems like that might not be the full story. But for Tim Fischer, it really was the case. Tim was the leader of the National Party and Deputy Prime Minister when he left politics. He decided that he needed to be with his wife, the farmer Judy Brewer, and with their sons, the eldest of whom, Harrison, had been diagnosed with autism. The family shared precious years together before Tim passed away from leukemia. Today, Judy lives where she has nearly all of her life, at the family farm in Mudgee-Gonga in northeast Victoria. Hi, Judy.
Hi, Sarah.
Tell me about this home of yours, Judy. How long has your family been in Mudgee-Gonga?
Well, it's a very special place. I feel so lucky to live there and to have had the opportunity to make it my home again completely forever for as long as I can. And so I'll tell you about it. It's a family farm, not a very big farm, but it has been in the family since my great-grandparents pioneered it in the 1870s. So it's 150 years in the family. And I'm very fortunate to live on the original block, although its borders have changed many times over the years, and also in the original house of my great-grandparents, Battista de Piazza and Catherine O'Brien.
How did Battista and Catherine first come to this part of Australia?
Oh, gosh, what a story. What a story. So, I mean, I love the story of Australia and rural Australia. Everyone has an incredible tale of why they live where they live. And for me, it was two immigrants who came essentially for the gold rush. My great-grandfather was Italian from the Valtellina up in northern Italy, a little place called Grosseto. And he came out for the gold rush at a time when there was a lot of poverty in the area he lived in. So he left Italy in 1863, hoping to just get here in time. But when he got to Beechworth and the gold rush areas of northeast Victoria, the gold rush had actually passed him by.
Oh, but no.
Yeah, so it was a long trip for, I won't say for nothing, but because I'm very glad he actually did it. But
what did he bring with him, Judy, all that way?
He didn't bring very much. He was 19. He came with two cousins. They walked from northern Italy to Genoa and then a boat to Liverpool and then Liverpool to Melbourne. They had nothing, absolutely nothing. And the lovely family story is that because he didn't smoke and there was rations of tobacco on the ship, that he saved all his rations. And when he got to Melbourne, he sold his rations so that he had enough to buy a backpack and walk to northeast Victoria with these two cousins. I can't prove this story, but there is always a family story that he did bring a grapevine, a piece of grapevine, and because we have a grapevine on the property that is supposedly the famous grapevine, the first Italian grapes in Australia, but I can't verify that, although I have been promising to DNA test it and see if there's any truth.
I'd just enjoy that story and enjoy the wine, I think.
Yeah, I think I'm too scared to actually DNA test it, Sarah, because I've got a horrible feeling that the thought that he might have actually picked off this little grapevine in Grosseto and put it in his pack all the way to Mudgee-Gonga, it just seems a little bit far-fetched. But anyway, we'll go with that.
We'll
for
go
now.
With that. And who did he meet in Mudgee-Gonga?
Well, fortunately for me, he met my great-grandmother, and she was an Irish. They're both very Catholic families, and she had come, the O'Briens had come from County Cork. And so they met, and they met when she was working in the lovely Avons Valley Hotel as a barmaid, and got married and went on to have 18 children, of whom 14 were born alive and of whom 12 got to adulthood,
my
so a very
goodness.
Large family, and that beautiful Italian-Irish combination of, I suspect, fieriness and family and fun, I think.
They built a house that you live in now. What's it look like?
Yeah. So we have two houses on the farm. So my mother is actually in the original house, so she's just turned 90 this week, and she lives in that house, and I live in a sort of almost next door in a attached house that we built about. We call it the new house because it's only 50 years old, and of course the old house is 150 years old. Shortly will be.
And what's that old house like?
The old house is a beautiful house. It's just, oh gosh, it has a sense when you walk in. It's incredibly designed and situated. I think back, they must have really known something about the environment and nature in those days that we didn't really know when we built the new house in the 70s, because the old house, as we call it, is so much easier to cool and to heat. It's facing where the wind blows up the valley, so you only have to open that front door, and there's a corridor that has just four bedrooms off the corridor and a living room at the back, and the wind will just come in and cool the whole place, whereas the lovely brick extravagance of the 1970s, I think, perhaps needs a little bit more renovation very soon, I think.
Judy, how did you come to visit the village in Italy where your great-grandfather set off from?
Sometimes you think things, you know, sort of almost can't happen, like they've become like a fairy tale. And when I was quite young, my sister and I, you know, were doing our trip around Europe, our backpacking sort of trip, and we decided we'd go to Grosseto and find this village and see if there was... We had no contact with anyone there. That there was a sister. We knew there had been a sister in the family, just Battista and his sister, Marguerite, but we had no contact and our Italian wasn't terribly good. And as we went to go to this village, the day before, there was a landslide, because it's right up in the Alps, and it actually took away the hotel that we were to stay in the next night. We were one day away from being in this landslide, the worst landslide the village has had in modern times, and we weren't able to get in. It was closed off for, you know, another year. So we didn't get there, and it was always this dream. And then when Tim was trade minister many, many years later, so I think it was 1998, he was on a trade mission to Milan, and I didn't travel with Tim very often. We had the boys, and I always had the farm in the background. And because it was Italy, because it was northern Italy, and I think it was a very short trip, it was one of those trips where he said, you know, please come, because, you know, you have the Italian connection. And we had a Sunday in there that was available, because usually with when you're on a trade mission or you're doing a trip as trade minister, every moment of every day is fully booked. But on the Sunday, we headed up a couple of hours north of Milan up these windy roads and ended up at Grosseto. And we had told them that we were coming, but we really didn't know anyone. Well, there's just no words to describe it. This tiny little village, the whole town standing in the street, the mayor who gave us, you know, basically the keys to the city, is about 200 residents, and we had the most wonderful day. They had done so much work. The local priest had got out the records of the Battista's birth. The local historian presented me with the family tree back to when people only had one name and in a big scroll. They had found the house he was born in.
Oh, what was that like? Tell me about visiting it.
Amazing. So it was... I still can picture what happened. We got to this house and they said there was a couple living in it, and it had changed a lot over the years. But they said, please come down to the cellar. Again, you know, my Italian is okay, but not fantastic. We went down to the cellar just with the couple that are living there, and they had put on this spread of homemade salami and cheese and homemade wine. And just Tim and I and this lovely couple, you know, we weren't expecting any of this. And we had this, you know, probably 11 o'clock in the morning, we were drinking beautiful wine and eating salami and cheese and, you know, the smell of this cellar. The house sort of revolved around the cellar, and that's also an interesting thing. Everything we saw in this village, I could say, oh, that's why we've got a cellar at Magiconga. That's why he built everything with rock. That's why he dug all these drains. Because one of the remarkable things was this village, even though it's so remote and far away from Magiconga, you could see exactly why he settled in Magiconga, because the village of Grosseto is a little village on the side of the Alps. Water runs down the village, like through the village, and so it is at Magiconga. We live in a beautiful mountainous... We have mountains on three sides of us. You know, we're quite up near the snowfields. It, again, is blessed by this spring-fed water that runs. At times you have to capture the water and, you know, work out how you're going to trap it or move it or how it doesn't flood the paddocks. And we're, you know, very lucky in that way. Not every year, but usually we are very blessed with water. So you could see those parallels, and you could see, you know, this young fellow comes to Australia and knows he'll never go back. You know, there's no possibility that he would ever see his family again. So he has to sort of make his living in Australia, and he finds somewhere, I think, that reminds him of home. That's my sense, which I had never understood till I went there. But the other thing that was incredible this day was we were to go to lunch, and as we walked to probably the only restaurant in town and walked into this lunch, and I said, oh, gosh, it's already full. And they said, no, they're your relatives. And the whole restaurant was filled with the relatives of his sister, the
wow.
generations, and who I didn't know existed, and I'd never had any contact. And I just looked around. I have some beautiful pictures of just standing there with these, you know, not terribly distant relatives, really, that I didn't know existed, that my dad didn't know existed, my grandmother didn't know existed, and how wonderful to live in an age that you can not only meet them, but we've stayed in touch.
Was there any physical resemblance, Judy, or was it too far back?
Oh, yes, absolutely. Incredibly. We have a lovely thing in our family called the De Piazza nose, which I have been, you know, my genes have gifted to me, perhaps not in a nice way, but there was definitely a few De Piazza noses in the crew.
So this great-grandfather Batista and great-grandmother Catherine started the farm. It was passed down eventually to your dad. It's where you were born. What happened, Judy, when you were 17 and away at school? What happened to change your relationship with the farm then?
Well, something quite devastating, to be honest, because I had just all my life I'd wanted to farm. And my parents were very big on education. We all went to boarding school. I went to boarding school at 11, which was very young, and I hated every moment of it, not through anything particularly that was done at the boarding school, although I must admit Ballarat Catholic boarding schools in the 1970s were not quite the place to be. But I came home hoping to farm, and Dad had always said, no, you've got to get another qualification. Farming's never going to, you know, pay the bills. And both he and Mum had to work off farm, you know, most of the time, because farming was just not a very successful career for anyone at that in the 70s. So I had been arguing about this for a long time. Could I have a gap year, which was something that I really wanted to do that no one did in 1981. But my father dropped dead one morning, just very suddenly, about to get up, you know, 7 o'clock in the morning, got up. That was it. No, we didn't expect it. We were not ready for it. He hadn't done any succession planning on the farm. You know, it was just the biggest shock in the world. You know, your dad's your dad. You don't think, oh, gosh, he's getting on a bit. You know, he's not well. He was really well, and he was farming and riding the horse and doing everything. It was just devastating. I can't describe it. We were in the middle of a drought. So 81, it was just the worst year on the farm, I think, in history. It was this sort of, the family just came to a dead halt. My brother and sister were both at university. I'm the youngest, and there was nothing but for me to come home on the farm. And so I came home on the farm in the middle of a terrible drought, knowing very little, even
though
I'd grown up on
the farm. Came home with what plan, Judy, to run the farm?
Well, I think just to hold it together, because that was the main thing. And there was a lot of discussion with my mother as to who was going to go to work. And we decided in the end, well, we both went to work, but Mum was able, at 17, I wasn't going to earn a lot of money. I remember, you know, picking strawberries. I had three jobs at one point, you know, making beds in the local motel, pulling beers in the hotel and trying to keep the farm together. And then Mum was able to actually go back to full-time work because we had unfortunately bought another property not long before Dad died. And so we were still in the process of paying that off. Cattle prices were abysmal through a drought. I had just said how much water we had on our property. This was the only time in those 150 years that the springs failed. And so we were carting water to feed stock. Just, it was the worst timing.
Were you having to get rid of stock as well in that drought?
Absolutely. We got rid of everything we could. But again, I didn't know enough about farming. I mean, I've learnt a lot since. It's a few years on now. And you know, if I could go back then, I would have done things differently. I think probably the drought taught me all the things I didn't know. And then when the drought broke, that was the crazy thing. We were feeding cattle every day, trying to get hay in and feed from grains, and we're trying to do everything to keep them alive. And then finally the rain came after 2 years, and more cattle died after the rain came than died in the drought, because the cattle were not ready for the green feed, and we didn't know enough about nutrition. I didn't know enough about nutrition to ease them back into the normal sort of feeding. So I remember that sense of, oh, the drought's broken, but the problems only got worse. And then, of course, the debt got worse and everything else. It was very hard. And I have no doubt, you know, that it was the hardest time of my life. And everything since has probably been, in comparison, not so difficult.
How did you first get involved in local politics, Judy?
Well, that was about 2 years in. So as I said, once the drought had sort of started to break and we're starting to get our head above water again, I think my mother realised that I'd become very isolated. And as I said, 17, 18, I was not ever leaving the farm. I wasn't involved in anything. I was very depressed, very depressed. I wouldn't see people days on end and my life had sort of stopped. And she was very encouraging of me to, you know, join some local groups or find some friends locally somehow. You know, I was trying to think what sort of group. And I wanted to be with other people who were farming. I was always passionate about farming. I wanted to stay on the farm. I knew I needed to learn a lot. But also I'd grown up in a family that they were not actively in politics. They were very engaged in the world, as a lot of farming families are. You know, the ABC was on all the time, you know. Like, we watched the ABC news together every night from the time I was born, you know. And we were always in tune with the news, with politics. Dad would talk politics. And I always had a bit of an interest in politics. So when I found there was a young National Party, had no connection to the National Party, but there was a young National Party forming in Albury or Donga, which was probably only an hour's drive away, I thought maybe this is the thing, but I was very underconfident. And in fact, the first meeting that I went to, and it was literally, you know, reading something in the paper and turning up at a certain hotel at 6 o'clock one night or whatever. And my mother drove in with me and actually sat in the car the whole time I was at the meeting, because she knew that I wouldn't get out of the car. She knew I would not go in the door unless she was push, push, push. You know? But I did go in the door, and that was the next turning point in life.
What did you look like back then at 19?
No, don't do that. I said, I was a bit disconnected with what probably was fashionable at the time. I do remember getting my hair permed, and I have the most dreadful brown straight hair. You know, I did. It's rather grey now, but, you know, it was like I've got a picture of that night. And the reason I have a picture of that night was on my first night I was elected publicity officer of the newly formed Albury Wodonga Young National Party. And I hadn't held any position ever in my life, but I felt, oh, my gosh, this was a huge thing. And the picture shows me with this disgusting permed hair, a very ill-fitted coat of my mother's that I probably thought was political, wearing a sort of, you know, brown jacket, again, very brown, and looking basically terrified in the back row of this picture, so, which sums it up very well.
Yeah, you were the new publicity officer. How involved did you go on to be in that Young Nationals Party?
I don't do things by halves, Sarah, I'm sorry. I suddenly had something other than the farm and the animals, and so I did. I became very involved, and so that was 1983. By 1987, I was the federal president of the Young National Party. So it was a very, very big part of my life.
What did that mean for you? What kind of doors did it open to have that role as a young woman who had been so isolated on the family farm?
Oh, it opened up so much. It just totally life-changing. And, you know, in the 80s, the National Party was not what it is now. I have to tell you, it was a very different beast. Not necessarily a better or worse, but very different. Much more grounded in rural communities and branches. There were branches everywhere. So once I joined the Young National Party, I became, you know, secretary of the Wodonga branch, then secretary, being female, I had to be the secretary of the local electorate council, and then secretary of the state electorate council, getting on centrally. Like, there were so many different little groups that you could just keep moving up the ladder. And eventually I broke the rules and became chair of both the state seat and the federal seat. And again, I was only in my early 20s.
Is this also, Judy, how you got to meet Mr. Tim Fisher?
Well, yes, I suppose so. I say that, yeah, so many people over the years have said, how did you and Tim meet? And, you know, we both used to say the same thing. We have no idea, really. There was no, you know, clashing of eyes across the crowded room or music you know, fading in and out, but it was something much duller than that. We suspect we were probably at the same meetings for a long time before we had any thought that the other person existed. And slowly we realised we did know each other, but only in that going to meeting sense. So I knew when I was Federal President of Young Nationals, I would run into him at the conferences, and we had one very funny, we often reflected on a very funny trip I did to, again, I hadn't travelled. And at one point, Tim and I found ourselves both in Perth. He was the Federal National Party West Australian liaison officer. Sounds really great. I don't know what
girl
that
could
meant.
Resist.
Yeah, exactly. And I'm there for, yeah, and we ended up at the, I remember at Parliament House at the same dinner and having a laugh saying, oh, you know, a long way from Albury. But that was all it was, you know, it was a friendship that evolved over a long period of time. And
do you remember the moment where it shifted for you from seeing him as a friend and an older mentor, I guess, to something else?
Well, I think you've sort of hit the nail on the head. He was an older mentor, and he was 18 years older than me. So I was probably only 19 when we met. So he didn't even come across my radar as someone other than an older mentor for probably, you know, we didn't marry for another 10 years. So it was, you know, a very slow, I suppose a fear almost that this was becoming too serious, and but we couldn't talk about it because it was so ridiculous, you know. It was we had that sense of becoming closer to each other and talking more and travelling to things together, and he would ring me and I'd look forward to catching up with him. But it was never, we both, you know, had other lives and social lives, but it just kept sort of being there. And one day he said to me, oh, I've got this dreadful thing, you know, I have to do all these, always got to find partners for things. This is how romantic he was. I have a little book, you know, and I have some single women in there that, you know, I might, would you like to join the list so I could take you to, you know, if there's things on. And I remember it was around the bicentennial. And he said, oh, it's 1988 and, you know, there's the opening of the new Parliament House and then there's all this, there's something at the opera. Now, he said, I've got someone for that and I've got someone for that, but I haven't got anyone for the Token World Debutante Ball. Do you think, you know, that might be something you'd like to come to? And I suppose, you know, I hadn't ever considered going to the Token World Debutante Ball. And it took a fair bit of thinking to think whether that was something I wanted to go to. But I did go, and I suppose in reality that was our first date, a date that really didn't go very well at all.
Do you want to say more?
Well, he didn't tell me it was 2 hours in a car and that we were going to have dinner with the local priest before we got to the debutante ball. And we got to the debutante ball, something I have a slight abhorrence, and people are going to be annoyed with me now listening to that as a former wife of a federal member of parliament. But debutante balls were not big in Mudgee-Gonga. It was a Riverina thing. They were very big in Tim's electorate. They were all, and they have a place, and they have a wonderful place, and people love them. But I had never been to one. But this day I did dress up, got the bouquet and had the flowers and I did all the right things. But Tim got sick halfway through the night. And by the time we'd got to the car to drive home, he was very sick, like very sick. He had a terrible flu and it was dark. It was foggy. It was 2 hours driving along the highway next to the Murray River. And he said, do you mind if you drive and I'll sleep on the back seat? Because I've got to go to Canberra tomorrow or whatever. And that's exactly what he did. So I drove back and dropped him at his motel and thought, well, I'm never doing that again. About 2 months later, he said, oh, I've got another invitation for you. I said, I'm not interested. I'm really not interested. I said, no more dead balls. He said, oh, no, it's the Queen. And I said, what, the Queen? What? I wasn't quite sure it was the band, the Queen, or what Queen it was, but it was the Queen. It was QE2 coming to Albury, which was his electorate, again, for the bicentennial, and I thought, I can't pass that one up. So, yeah,
and
I
that
said
one
yes
went
again.
Better.
Not a lot better. It was really just that, you know, sense that there was someone that you couldn't really live without them in your life, you know, that was, I think, the same for him.
You must have been conscious that being married to a politician was going to mean something very different than being married to someone out of politics. I mean, once you had your two sons, Judy, how often were you at home alone in those early years without Tim?
Well, I think you're right in the sense that when we got married, you know, I would meet other federal members of parliament and their wives or partners or spouses, and they would be like, "Oh, life has changed so much, and I didn't sign up for this when I married, you know, Fred or Maria, whoever it was." Let me say, it was more likely to be Fred if it was the National Party. But so they were sort of going through that shock. For me, Tim was a member of parliament when I met him, so I didn't really have that fallback of saying, look, and I was involved in politics. I had a sense of what politics was like. So I thought I was well equipped to manage it. And I was also a very independent person. I'd spent a lot of time on the farm on my own. So that part didn't worry me. But when I had the kids, it changed a lot. Tim would be home. Firstly, we finally got into government in 1996. Our first son was born in 1993 and our second son was born 3 months after we got into government. Mm. And so I had, you know, a three-year-old and a toddler and a baby through the busiest times of Tim's political career. So he was Deputy Prime Minister, he was Trade Minister, he was leader of the National Party, and he was facing perhaps the biggest issues the National Party had faced in many, many years.
Judy, when your sons were little, that was when Tim was pushing so strongly for gun control after the Port Arthur massacre. What impact did that debate over guns and gun control have on you and the boys?
I just said how strong I was. It showed me I was not strong, I think, because he was a lot stronger than I was. I felt it was the worst period of our political life by far. I certainly saw a side of humanity and people and country people who I love dearly and who are usually so warm and accommodating and understanding, but there were people very, very angry about this and taking it out very much on Tim. And when they couldn't take it out on Tim, they would take it out on us because we were home. We were the ones answering. I was the one answering the phone every night, remembering we didn't have mobile phones then, so we had one landline into our house, and at that point we were living at Borey Creek. But Tim was, as I said, wouldn't have been home a night a week, probably two nights a month. And we were 4 kilometres to our nearest neighbour, and the phone would just ring incessantly with abuse, absolute abuse. There would be all anonymous. You know, Tim always had his phone in the phone book. There used to be a thing called a phone book, Sarah. It's
like vague memories.
You could look up Fisher and it'd say Tim, and that was our phone number. And so if you wanted to give him a burst, that was what you did. He was not likely to be there. And I answered the phone at the other end. We really did cop some terrible abuse. Not only abuse, we had death threats and we had to have federal police and security. We had some very, what they would call, viable death threats. We never really understood them. But, you know, you'd be out at Borey Creek and suddenly the police would arrive and they would set up camp in the garage in 40-degree heat, and then just as quick as they went, a few days later they'd disappear, and you were never really told what the threat was. Occasionally they would say, look out for this number plate, or they would give you a picture of someone. I don't think I was ever so much scared as just, when would this end? You know, is this how we were going to live now? You know, the bullets in the mail of white feathers.
People would post bullets and white feathers.
I wasn't allowed to open the mail. All our private mail had to be opened. I remember getting parcels and they had to be left at the door and then they'd be taken away and scanned and they'd come back. You know, it might have been a Christmas present, but there was that sense that, you know, the threats were that viable, unfortunately, and it's hard talking about it now to even imagine that could be the case. Like, it's so incredible, but it was true. And we had to have police protection for a long time. And for a baby and a toddler that at that point was undiagnosed with autism and going through a huge amount of issues, very hyperactive, having a lot of anxiety issues as well, which I now recognise as anxiety issues, not liking strangers, all those things, everything just escalated to a point that became really just unbearable. Mm.
What happened one night with your younger son, with Dominic, to help convince Tim that he should step away from politics?
Yeah, well, that was a hard one because poor Dom, you know, so we got into government in March. He was born in July. He just didn't have the chance to even get to know his dad at all. You know, he saw other people much more than he saw his dad. So Dad, and I have to say, Tim is a larger than life figure. You know, he really is a man that had so much energy and presence. So 6'3", big bloke, hat, you know, usually a stick, the whole carrying briefcases. So he'd come home and he'd burst in the door and it'd be like a little whirlwind, you know, things, like paper would flatter, you know, flap away, you know, it was like, and he'd be, oh, here I am, home, you know, I'm here, here I am, Dom, here, Harrison, where are you, Judy, you know. Everything was done in this fairly extreme and dramatic manner with Tim. And one night we were actually at Mudgeegonga. We'd moved back to Mudgeegonga, you know, to live on the farm because that was my safety and I knew that I could be safe there with the boys. And so we'd moved back there and that was very difficult for Tim because he was out of the electorate firstly, which was challenging. So he was still trying to sort of live at Borey Creek when he was home. And anyway, he came in the door at Mudgeegonga one night. I think he'd been away about 3 weeks and Dom just hid behind the chair shaking. He was terrified of him, absolutely terrified of him. And Tim's going, Dom, Dom, and Dom's going, no, 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 you know, and I never saw Tim as upset as that night. And after, you know, the kids had gone to bed, he said, oh, I can't have my 2-year-old scared of me. I can't have him hiding behind the chair. That's not what I signed up for. I want to be a proper parent. And I think that was really one of the key moments. There were a few like that where the kids, you know, there was just such a disconnect happening between the kids and Dad. And as I said, we didn't, you know, he came to fatherhood later in life. He just wanted to be present for them. I must admit, I didn't think he would go through with it. He talked about it on and off and, you know, there was a sense that, I know my mother said, oh, I knew he would get out. I don't think I ever did because he loved it too much. He'd been in politics for 30 years. He'd been pre-selected at 23. It was his life and he loved people. He loved travel. He loved politics, the good and the bad. There's nothing he enjoyed more than a country show and followed by a night branch meeting followed by, you know, meet and greet at the council. You know, he thrived on that sort of life. Many people would find that incredible, myself included. But he did. He loved it. And so for him then to think about giving it away, we'd seen off guns. We'd sort of, in a sense, seen off Pauline Hanson, unfortunately not permanently. But he was sort of on top of things again. Trade was going very well. They were likely to win the next election. The Olympics were coming. You know, it was 1999. There was a lot to look forward to. There was that sense of optimism in the country around the turn of the century. To be Deputy Prime Minister in those circumstances is such a privilege. So when he did say, oh, I'm thinking about giving it away, I really didn't believe it would happen. And it happened very suddenly in the end. I was at Mudgeegonga. He rang me one night and said he'd just been to New Zealand on a trade trip and he was literally at the airport and said, I've decided to resign tomorrow. I'm going in to tell John Howard now. And he said, you better get in the car and come up. And I thought, oh, this will be a wasted trip. But I did. I got in the car. 5 hours later, arrived at Canberra, pulled in under Parliament House to find a couple of his staff waiting for me in the car park. And I said, he's not serious, is he? And they were all in tears. He'd just told them. And there was no turning back. So, yeah, it was very sudden when it came. And I think we were all in shock for a long time. And I think he was in shock for about 20 years, to be honest. But I have to say the 20 years post-politics in our life was the happiest time of our life.
Let's talk about your first son, about Harrison. What was Harrison like as a baby?
Well, when I look back, I actually don't know how we survived, to be honest. So many things happened at once. You know, we'd got married, we'd had an election. He was very, very busy campaigning because, you know, they'd lost the election that was supposed to be unlosable. They couldn't lose the next one. He was so busy. We had our first child. Neither of us knew what to do. There weren't little kids around our life. And so when Harrison came home from hospital and he wouldn't settle, he said he couldn't be consoled. He cried all day, all night. He was constantly hospitalised for ailments that we weren't quite sure what they were. He'd have ear infections. He was just the most unhappy child, and he wouldn't eat, he wouldn't breastfeed, he didn't crawl, he missed all his milestones. He didn't walk till he was 2, you know, he had no language, all those things. I had no concept that there was a word going to actually describe those things in some sort of global sense. So I was just living with the what are we doing wrong, and every time we'd see a medical professional. Unfortunately, in those days, it was, what are you doing wrong? It was all about parents not providing the environment for their child to, you know, to meet their milestones rather than them being something intrinsically different about Harrison.
Was it a relief then for you to get this diagnosis of autism?
It was an enormous relief, an enormous... For me, I don't think for Tim. I think for Tim it was actually, he wasn't ready for that. And again, he'd been absent a lot, so he hadn't seen it as closely as I had. For me, it was suddenly, oh, you mean it's not something I'm doing? You know, it's actually him. And it was the start of, you know, he's now 27, the start of realising that's just him. And he's great and he's fantastic. He's one of the most incredible people you'll ever meet in your life. But he's different. He's different. And he was different then and he's different now. And, you know, I suppose for me, one of the greatest things that happened was having Dom, because you know, 2.5 years later, we had another child, same parents, same genetics, same household, same crazy political environment, same slightly manic parents, all those things, but totally different child, a child that walked early, talked early, you know, did all those things. So suddenly it was like, well, how could those two children in the same home be so different? Unless it was an intrinsically different thing, as autism is. So that helped a lot, but... It took me many years to get my head around what autism was. It was very misunderstood for many years. It still is, but not as much. And we've made huge progress in really understanding neurodiversity, thankfully.
So this was this huge personal family journey that you'd embarked on. When did you make the decision, or how did you make the decision to become an activist for other families like yours?
It seemed that for me, well, I have to say, my brother had come home on the farm and relieved me of so much of the farm work. I was freer then to be with Tim and the family, and I had that sense of how can I use this situation to actually be meaningful. I'm not backward in coming forward. The Young Nats did teach me something, and that was you have a voice, you can use it. And you need to use it because life's pretty short and there's a lot of things we need to change, you know. And I've always had that sense that there are so many things we need to do better, and I was actually put right into a situation where there were no services, and I mean no services, there were no federal programs for autism at all. There was families doing it so tough. You know, there was no special schooling, there were no integration aids, there was no training. So even once we got to the point of thinking about schooling, there were no options. And in Canberra, and no offence to Canberra, but I went to, I think, pretty much every school in Canberra that was a possibility to try to get Harrison into a mainstream environment to be told no. And at that point, autism wasn't recognised as a special for special schools, so we couldn't get in there either. We were absolutely stranded with no education possibility for him at 5, 6.
Where did you end up finding somewhere for him to go?
Well, the beauty of Mudgee-Gonga. I come back to where I started, the lovely country communities that don't have these ideas about people having to fit into a particular box. And I walked in the door in December in tears because my mother had said, just go down to the school, you know, see if they'll take him. I said, well, the best schools in Canberra aren't prepared to take him. Like, you know, I can't imagine Mudgee-Gonga having the facilities. You know, it's a tiny school. And I remember walking in and the school had closed for the year and there was a lady on a painting the wall on a little ladder. And I said, is the teacher around? And she said, I am the teacher. She's unfortunately not with us anymore, but her name, she had a lovely name. Mrs. Monster was her name. She became a wonderful, wonderful friend. I know. So she introduced herself as Mrs. Monster, and I thought, this is going well. So Carolyn, she became just a wonderful, wonderful friend. And it even went for, so I started saying, look, my son, you know, he's been diagnosed with this, and we've been to all these schools and he needs all this help and I don't know what to do and it's nearly January and he's got to start school. And she said, stop. I don't care what he's got. Don't bring me any paperwork. This school's for everyone. He can come here. I'll enrol him. She didn't want to know anything about him other than he existed, and it was the most wonderful start to school that any kid could have, you know. By the time Dom started there, I think there were 9 students, of which they were 2. The cows were being milked in the paddock next door. Kids were roaming free. It didn't matter if the shoes were on or off. They had the most limited library imaginable, but the kids thrived. And, you know, we don't need all the magical technology. We just need someone to care. and to accept and to belong, as he did.
As Harrison grew older, Judy, what kind of relationship did he and Tim develop with one another?
That's an interesting question because, of course, as time went on, we started to also realise that there were elements of autism that Tim identified with as well. And he realised that very quickly. I realised it, of course, as soon as I started understanding what it was. And I thought, Tim does that, you know. Well, that's a bit like Tim, you know. And it's very, as I said, autism is a very general term. But there were certainly things that Tim did that, and one of them was, you know, this innate curiosity he had about everything. You know, Tim had to know how things worked and he would go very deep into things. I often think people didn't really know Tim at all. The superficial Tim that you saw on the television was not him. That was just the person with the hat, the quirky, all that stuff. The real Tim was someone who had an insatiable curiosity for everything. He read every day. He read everything. He couldn't wait to get out of bed in the morning because the day would hold some new adventure for him. There was never a day that he didn't make use of the day and learn something. He did that all his life. He sought out the other. Because I think he identified as an other as well, because he was different. And as time went on and he started to realise that fitted, you know, somewhere in the autism spectrum, he understood Harrison a lot better as well. And they developed a wonderful relationship over the years that we would never have had if he hadn't got out of politics when he did.
Tim died from leukaemia and was given a state funeral. When you remember that day, Judy, what stands out in your mind?
It was a very strange thing. The whole thing was so strange. Tim had been sick for a very long time. You know, he'd had 10 years of fighting cancer, 4 different cancers. And this last one, we knew for a while it was going to be the one that he couldn't beat, although he always had the belief he just might be the one that beat it. But particularly the last few weeks when he was in palliative care and it was very, very tough and, you know, a slow realisation that it was a matter of days. And then suddenly having to put on this incredible state funeral. And he had said to me, if they offer me a state funeral, you're to accept it. I think probably personally I would have thought I would rather not, because I was dreading the thought that we'd have to go straight into that. But he had said it very clearly and he had very much controlled his death and what was to happen afterwards. So I tried to abide by his wishes and we went for the state funeral, but it became so much bigger than anything I'd imagined. The people just were so generous and people put together the train from the Lachlan Valley Railway Association. You know, they're polishing up the historical train and bringing Tim in on the rail line. Oh, it was just like something you couldn't believe. And then his wonderful veteran community, because Tim became sicker, he actually, one of the things that he really let go of, so Tim was a Vietnam veteran. For many years, he just wouldn't speak about it at all. It was not something he ever wanted to talk about. But as he got sicker, he became closer and closer to that community and to his mates from Vietnam. And they had been so supportive when he was in hospital. They'd be visiting and cheering him up. And so we had that lovely service for him, an RSL service as well. And then we had this big, you know, televised state service with everyone there. It was incredibly hard for the boys to go through that sort of day. And then we had his burial and then we had my beautiful Mudgee-Gonga community at the end of the day opening the hall for the night of nights where we just all relaxed and said, well, we got through that day, you know. And he would have loved that too. And they loved him and it was just an incredible way to finish a day that had started at 4 a.m. with a trip to a train, then an RSL service, then a state funeral bigger than Ben-Hur, then a private burial, and finally the Mudgee-Gonga Hall. So the day was a day I'll never, ever go through anything like, please, ever again. But I think it was exactly what he would have wanted, and that gives me great comfort. Very tough on the boys, as I said. They just were so strong and brave getting through it all.
The context of that big public funeral is, of course, very different, but I can't help but think you're someone who lost their dad young too. Was that something you could share with the boys?
Yeah, I'm sure it helped and it helps now. And, you know, they're both, because I do understand, I think people, losing your dad is just so big in your life, or losing your mum, you know, losing your partner's big too, but it's different.
How has it been for you this year without Tim?
Tim, I knew him incredibly well. I mean, I knew him for 35 years. You know, we were partners for 30. There's a part of Tim that I've never met anyone like him. He was such a unique person, and he was a little bit at times goofy. You know, he could be quirky. He could be, you know, he had these odd, people say, oh, he's the train man, the train spotter, all that stuff. He'd wave the hat, he'd do all that. You know, he had a lot of quirkiness. But again, if you see it through the context of he actually was intrinsically a shy person, but who also loved people, it's like that incredible paradox of this kid that grew up in Borey Creek, went to the local school, had a speech impediment, couldn't play sport because he was so uncoordinated. It just was sort of overlooked for a long time, and then eventually rose to become the Deputy Prime Minister and do something, not just that, after politics, what he did unsaid, largely privately, with so many organisations, not-for-profit. He just gave all his time to service in refugee causes, East Timor, Fred Hollows Foundation, you know, as chair of the Flying Doctor Service. He was just intrinsically a good person. I'm not trying to rewrite history or have rose-coloured glasses, because he wasn't an easy person to live with, I tell you, because no day was wasted. You know, we used to joke when he was very sick that we finally got to sit up and watch TV together, you know, because he couldn't actually get out of bed, you know, like it took that much for him to actually stop. He worked so hard. He was one of a kind.
There must be a big gap in your life.
An enormous gap, Sarah, but I'm also very lucky that, you know, I had that opportunity. Who would have thought my life would have gone down that path? And more than that, it's come the full circle, and I'm home. I'm farming very seriously now.
Well, tell me about the farm now and what your hopes for it and plans for it are.
Well, as the years have gone, I've just loved the farm more and more. I mean, I loved it as a child. I always loved animals. I loved watching things grow. I was surrounded myself, dogs and cats and chooks and ducks and geese and cows. And I realised at one point that I was a bit lost without growing things. So going back to farming has made a big difference to me. I've had some mental health issues over the years, and I know in those periods where I've been low, that grounding of farming and growing and being surrounded by nature is the greatest antidote to depression that I've ever discovered. Far better than pills, even though pills have their place. So my dream, I suppose, with this beautiful property that's been in the family so long and has a history that is just magic. And when I'm there, I just, you know, I have my beehives, I have my animals, try to be self-sufficient in vegetable growing, I run the cattle myself. It's physical work that keeps you mentally, for me, it keeps me mentally acute and happy. So the idea of sharing that with more people, for the rest of my life, that's what I want to do. I want to share the farm. I want to create a care farm where people can come in and out and be part of this. You know, I have a plan, and I was lucky enough to get a Churchill Fellowship to look at care farming overseas. It's something that's done in Europe very well. It's done in the US. It's done in particularly in the UK, Ireland. In Holland, you know, there are 1,000 care farms. In Iceland, there are care farms. In Australia, we have this great divide between farmers and people that have never set foot on a farm. My plan is a day care farm. So it's the people come and go by the day, and each day we put on different activities. Or they can walk down around the paddocks, they can meet the animals, they can dig in the vegetable garden. There'll be different things at different times. I have a plan, and I'm hoping in the next year or so that it'll be able to be open and that we can look after people, particularly people that are vulnerable. And life is so, you know, you've just got to grab it, you know, and you've just got to find a way that you bring whatever your interests and gifts are to make them work together and keep sort of advancing. You know, it's around when you lose someone you love, you do have that real sense of how short life is and how you have to really take the opportunities, and it's very easy to sort of hide away. But Tim always dreamt of this sort of better place, and I really do too. I just think Australia is so in such a good position, but we need to actually start thinking about other people, and we don't do it enough.
You and Tim shared a Catholic faith. Do you think of him looking down in some sense?
I think of him chastising me often. I'm not sure about the looking down. I'm terrified he'd be looking down saying, why are you doing that, you know? He'd be looking down at me now saying, but you hate interviews. Why, all the times I wanted you to do interviews and you said, no, I'm not the politician. I think he'd be, I do have a real sense of him. It scares me sometimes. And, you know, I think we do of all the people that we love that have gone. I have a real sense of my dad on the farm. I have a sense of my great-grandparents on the farm. You know, I have this real spiritual sense. There's a spirit world of some sort. I don't understand it, and it's probably not my Catholic faith as much as just a sense of being a very small thing in the world compared to the universe that is so beyond our comprehension. But I'd like to think that somewhere out there there's some sense of Tim still going on.
Judy, thank you so much for being my guest on Conversations.
Oh, look, it's a joy. I love listening to the conversations. It's fascinating hearing people's stories. And, mine's only a small story, but I hope there's still a little bit to go.
I spoke with Judy in 2020, and Judy has now opened her farm in Mudgee, Gonga, as a social farm to help vulnerable adults, and we'll include a link with more information on our website and in the show notes. This episode of Conversations was produced by Nicola Harrison, and the executive producer was Carmel Rooney. I'm Sarah Kanoski. Thanks for listening.
ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.